The ABC Radio Network presents Overseas Assignment, a weekly report from ABC News correspondents stationed in the news capitals of the world. This week's report covers the sounds and fury of an attempted coup in Saigon and a report from Berlin on the rise and predicted fall of an extreme right party in West Germany. First, ABC's Charles P. Arno on the scene last weekend when Vietnamese strongman General Khan and his troops crushed an attempted coup by predominantly Roman Catholic military leaders. These are the sounds of battle in the streets of Saigon, scooped up by Arno's tape recorder from almost as soon as the action began until it was apparent the rebels had given up.
This is Charles P. Arno reporting on February 20th from outside of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and this is where the showdown is of the military coup. Jeeps and trucks have blocked traffic here, and we're just seeing whether it's possible to get through. Lots of troops here in battle gear, and they've blocked off all this road with one, two, three, four. There are a dozen trucks here. I brought the troops in. They are making an attack against the rebels who are holding out in the Joint Chiefs of Staff headquarters and the adjacent airport. A helicopter is going low overhead, and apparently the rebels have decided to make a stand at the airport and in the headquarters of the Joint Chiefs.
Portable 2 to USAM, portable 2 to USAM.
Many of these troops have walkie-talkies, and we're in a tight moment here at the end of 18 hours of this attempted coup to overthrow Khan. General Khan has brought up reinforcements, and now we're in what they call the crunch. The troops have every alleyway here lined up with heavily armed paratroopers, and we're just waiting to see now what is going to be the situation, because the rebels still control the Joint Chiefs of Staff headquarters and also the airport, and they appear to be wanting to hold out. Planes are flying overhead very low. They haven't bombed anything yet, but it could be any moment. You are a paratrooper?
Right, thank you.
But 43 paratroopers?
Yeah, 40.
43. Uh-huh. You come into town today?
Today you get.
Uh-huh. I'm speaking here with a Vietnamese paratrooper. He's got a couple of grenades on his belt, knife, and a submachine gun. He's all set to go. Just talking here to Bill Malden, the cartoonist, I should say famous cartoonist from Chicago. Bill says doesn't look very gung-ho to him. He doesn't think that maybe they're going to let have it one another here. But of course, in Vietnam, as we've learned, that if one starts shooting, they all start shooting, and we're all still waiting here. The tanks that were down about 300-400 yards down the street here appear to have pulled out. Just where, I'm not sure. But the joint headquarters here certainly appears to have been surrounded by forces loyal to General Khan, and this may or may not be the thing that breaks the back of it. Overhead, there are still helicopters hovering. Places filled with curious onlookers. It's almost like a county fair if they don't start some shooting here. The troops have just pulled out of the headquarters of the Joint Chiefs of General Staff here on the edge of Saigon. Two large tanks are still protecting this, and there are lots of soldiers still inside. Some of the American and foreign military men are moving around with the Vietnamese, and we're not exactly sure just yet what the situation is. As one group pulls out, another group pulls in. You can hear the tanks roaring in now to the headquarters here, military headquarters. That's a medium tank just rolled by, and we're not exactly sure yet just whose tanks they are, but it appears that the back of this thing has been broken. In the midst of these tanks and trucks with troops, with mortars, with rifles, the tanks ready to go, on the ready, we seem to have a big development now and a big switch here in the situation at this coup d'etat, which has brought things to a rather critical halt here for the last 18 hours in Saigon, and certainly brought the war against the communists to a halt. That makes about the 19th truck load of troops moving out of the Joint Chiefs of Staff headquarters here. And here's a one-star general's car moving out. That was General Depew, the operations chief, General William Depew. As I shouted to him out of the car, his car, as he left the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is it all over, sir?
I really wouldn't know.
Oh, this is an Australian officer I was talking to. General Depew just told me when I asked him whether it was all over, he said, I hope so. The Americans here have been working all night to try to get this attempted coup settled and get back on the war against the communists. The real touchy thing and the touch-and-go thing, of course, here is the fact that the officers who staged this attempted coup were all supporters of the Catholic Diem regime. Most of them personally were Catholics, and this may cause tremendous new interreligious strife here in this already splintered country. We've got more armored troop carriers here moving down the street, and these boys are heavily armed. It's difficult to tell the players without the names and numbers because they all wear the same uniforms, but these are very obviously Khan's troops. Now just up ahead, I can see trucks loaded with troops loyal to General Khan, heavily armed, are moving in toward the military airport. And it would appear that perhaps the rebels have decided to give up.
ABC's Charles P. Arno reporting on the abortive coup against General Nguyen Khan. However, subsequent to Arno's report, Khan was removed as Supreme Commander by the Military Council and appointed to the post of Roving Ambassador. There are Nazi overtones in the organization of a new political party in West Germany, as reported now by ABC's Russell Jones in Berlin.
Something called the National Democratic Party has been holding organizational meetings in West Germany recently, making a blatant appeal to old or new Nazis. Formed of a coalition of splinter parties on the extreme right, the NDP now has branches in all West German states except one. Viewed out of the context of the times and Germany's post-war political record, these meetings could be frightening. Speakers call for devotion to the German people, to the German fatherland, and to the German Reich, an appeal all too reminiscent of Hitler's slogans. References are made to interned comrades, meaning Nazis still in Allied or West German prisons. And finally, one founding meeting was held in a beer hall not far from the Munich cellar that Hitler himself used. But there the similarity ends, for West Germany is not the Germany of the Weimar Republic that saw the rise of Hitler. The most prosperous nation in Western Europe, there is no appeal in West Germany for political extremism of any sort. Neither the left nor the right has had any success at all in bidding for electoral support. The national legislature is made up only of representatives of the Socialist, the Christian Democratic, and the Free Democratic parties, a spectrum of about the same span as that separating the Americans for Democratic Action from Goldwater Republicans. In the 20th year after the war, in the 10th since it became independent, West Germany has an almost impeccable record for respecting the democratic process while leaving a little leeway for harmless crackpots. And crackpots are certainly what the founders of the new party are. This does not mean they are not an embarrassment to the West German government. In its struggle to establish a functioning democracy in a country that knew little about a free society, the Bonn government has had to steer a careful course. While trying to prevent extremism, it has also tried to implant respect for the minority opinions and for constitutional rights and safeguards. This aim has not always been easy to achieve, partly at least because of the pressures from outside the country. Oddly enough, the greatest of these pressures come from the communist bloc and from the United States. And sometimes it is difficult to tell American critics from the communists. As an example, the East Germans make a regular practice of announcing with considerable fanfare what they claimed to be evidence that one or another of the West German leaders was a Nazi or a war criminal. Almost none of these accusations has proved to be true, but frequently they are picked up by American groups and without qualification passed on as fact. This practice has been carried to an extent where some Americans quote East German Justice Minister Hilda Benjamin as her source for their accusations. Mrs. Benjamin just happens to be one of the most notoriously bloodthirsty officials in the whole communist bloc, having presided over dozens of trials of anti-communists and handing down brutal sentences, including the death penalty. At the moment, Bonn is under great pressure to extend the statute of limitations on war crimes and to withdraw the German scientists who are working in Egypt. Taking the latter problem first, the argument is made that the scientists are helping a country pledged to exterminate Israel and that Germany owes the Jewish state a moral debt that requires it to help. But the groups who make this demand have yet to provide an answer to the constitutional quandary. How can any free government forbid its citizens the right to work in a country that, on paper at least, is a friendly power? And if German scientists were ordered out of Egypt, how about those in the United States, Britain, and India? The question of the statute of limitations is a much thornier problem. The German Constitution places a maximum 20-year limit on the prosecution of any crimes. Hitler rose to power by tampering with the self-same constitution, and the Bonn government wants no repetition of that. It believes that a democratic society rests on the inviolability of basic law. This is not to say that the West German government is not doing anything about these problems. It is using a combination of lures and pressures to get the scientists out of Egypt, and many of them have returned. Its legal experts are studying the statute of limitations, and the common belief is that a way of extending it will be found before May 8th, the 20th anniversary of VE Day. One suggested solution is that 1955, the year the Bonn government was established, be used as a starting date instead of the end of the war in 1945. In the meantime, the West Germans are continuing to run down war criminals and to bring them to trial, despite the fact that the communist bloc has many of the necessary records and has refused to turn them over without unacceptable political strings. The statute of limitations has an importance aside from the question of punishing criminals. The fact that 20 years have passed means that almost half of West Germany's 55 million people are too young to remember anything at all about the war or Hitler and his thousand-year Reich. A very high percentage reached the age of awareness only in the 10 years since the country was made independent. It is quite natural that these younger people are sick and tired of hearing about the sins of their elders. Not that they deny those sins, they are aware of them, but they leave the denials to those more guilty than they. The incriminated survivors of the elder generation are dying off, and literally none of them are in positions of political influence or importance. But these older people are the ones who are likely to join groups like the National Democratic Party. They join for a variety of reasons: unwillingness to admit they were wrong in supporting Hitler, desire to return to the eastern territories from which they were expelled, belief that Germany could make a deal with the Russians, some perhaps even for ideological reasons. But except as an excuse for critics to attack West Germany, none of these reasons matter. No extremist has ever been elected to the West German parliament, and the National Democrats aren't likely to be any more successful. Russell Jones, ABC, Berlin.
You've been listening to Overseas Assignment, a weekly report from ABC News correspondents stationed in the news capitals of the world. This week, a report from Charles P. Arno in Saigon and Russell Jones in Berlin. Overseas Assignment is a weekly presentation of the ABC Radio Network, produced in New York under the supervision of ABC Radio News.
Blair reports, weekends, on the ABC Radio Network.